location. The response was so great to our announcement of our speaker tonight, we decided it was wiser to put it in Hope Auditorium. And our judgment certainly seems to have been borne out. And we wanted to allow you enough time to all be seated, and so we did delay the proceedings for a few minutes. I'm Henry Snyder, the chairman of the Humanities Lecture Series, and I'm delighted to welcome you this evening on behalf of the Lecture Series to hear our distinguished speaker this evening. Before I introduce Dean Charles Kahn of the School of Architecture, who will introduce our speaker, I would like to remind you that the next lecture in the Humanities Series will be on April 7th in Woodruff Auditorium, and we will have Professor John Hall of Yale University talk on the subject of Pearl Harbor 30 years afterwards. And we hope to see all of you there, here, and many of you at least at our next meeting. And now, I would like to introduce Dean Charles Kahn, who will introduce our speaker for this evening. Dean Kahn.
Thank you, Henry. Standing before an audience such as this in an attempt to introduce Bucky Fuller is somewhat analogous to trying to introduce Pope Paul to the consistory of cardinals. Nevertheless, and with apologies to the University of Detroit, I take great pleasure in presenting to you sailor, machinist, comprehensive generalist, doer, reformer, student of trends, technical editor, businessman, angel, quarterback, lecturer, critic, experimental seminarist, random element, verb, comprehensive designer, inventor, engineer, architect, cartographer, philosopher, poet, cosmogonist, choreographer, visionary, scientist, valuable unit, mathematician, air pilot, Navy lieutenant, geometer, maverick thinker, gentle revolutionist, lovable genius, anti-academician, doctor of science, doctor of arts, doctor of design, doctor of humanities, amiable lunatic, prophet, custodian of a vital resource, humanist, R. Buckminster Fuller.
Such an introduction. I want to start off and by saying that having lived with myself for almost 76 years and being very familiar with myself as anybody could be, I'm not impressed at all. I can assure you that by 32 years of age, which was in 1927, I'd proven myself that I was, if I couldn't even call myself average, I was a low average character. And I tried hard to do things in athletics or whatever it might be, and there's just nothing fancy at all. But 1927 was a very critical year in my life, and it was, and I'm sure it would be in any of yours. In 1922, our first child, just before our fourth birthday, died, and she'd caught the end of World War I. She caught the infantile paralysis and spinal meningitis, and being unable to get around the way other children could, yet having all the interest any child had and what experience of being in our university. She wanted to know about things, and she had to find out through other human beings who did move around, because she couldn't get over to touch things and so forth. And we had a very extraordinary experience in that very frequently we had two trained nurses, they're changing watches, and my wife and myself, time and again, we were about to say something to one another. And before you had the sentence all framed on your lips, and just before you could get it out, our daughter would say that sentence, say the word. Many times there were kind of words a little child really wouldn't use. And so I became very deeply convinced that something was being manifested that probably was in all children, because what had happened to her was these were diseases, they were postnatal, it wasn't anything to do with the genes, but I felt that she was manifesting through her inability to get around and apply the capabilities of most children, she showed all ultimate capabilities that are probably in all children. And the same way, Klaus, you and I would say, you just have to say, quite clearly, telepathy seemed to be a faculty that was being manifest. They would say, they were not her words, but our words. I'm sure that every one of you have had experiences that you can only way you explain it just is the word telepathy, and yet the word telepathy has no specific meaning in any of our lives as yet, and though you feel, because you do have these strange experiences, that there may be something going on. But this child really made it very, very clear to me that something very powerful. And in many ways, she manifested other alternative capabilities. So in 1927, our second child was born, 5 years after the death of our first one. And we'd been really deepest kind of grief about it, and suddenly had this new life entrusted, made me really take stock of myself, wondering how I have to carry on. And I'd like to just say a few things about my early life, because they're not unusual at all, but they're special package of items. And for one thing, for instance, my father died when I was very young, and my mother was obviously loved me very much, and she was very eager for me to not be at a disadvantage when my father was dead. And friends would say to her, they'd be very glad to talk to her boy and trying to help her along. And my mother would say, "Now, listen, that man, he knows just what he's saying, he knows what he's talking about." And time and again, I didn't tend to feel that what I was being told didn't feel right to me, but I didn't, and my mother said, "Never mind what you think, listen, that man, he knows what he's talking about, he's taking a lot of trouble to let you know." So I knew that she'd taken also a considerable sacrifice, had spending some of her pretty scarce capital. She was sending me to a school which had to pay for, not a public school, feeling that she was getting me the best, and knowing again that she loved me very much in doing that. I assumed that what I had been told at the school, even though I didn't always agree with what I was hearing, that I felt that I must be wrong and not there at all. She simply, in her love, kept saying, "Never mind what you think, listen to what they're saying, that's why I'm sending you there." So I became really very good at listening to other people and suppressing my own thoughts. And by the age of, I was 32 in 1927, I was in really great pain, because I had been learning how to play all the different roles the different people gave me. And the trouble was, they had different strategies. And because you're not doing the thinking yourself, I had many things I was doing just in collision course. And so I just really got in a lot of trouble. In 1927, and for the first time, I said, I'm really going to have to do my own thing. It was a new child, and we were absolutely bust, no money, and we were in Chicago. Like both of our families were East Coast people, and so here we were, more or less, with strangers and broke, and a new, lovely, wonderful, extraordinary child. So I say this is the point where I really saw what my kind of a record seemed to be. But I said, if you're going to do your own thinking, there are really some very prominent questions you have to ask. For instance, I've been brought up with, you don't get this emphasis in much today, but you hear enough of it to realize that older people probably did say this much more. But certainly, as I grew up, all my contemporaries were all, as they were going to school, and they were going there with the idea of how are you going to earn a living. Earning a living was a very considered pretty difficult matter, and you hoped that you might earn a living as something you like to do, but you couldn't count on that at all, and you hoped that possibly then someday you'd get around to doing what you'd like to. But this then seemed to me, by age of 32, am I going to really do my own thinking? It seemed to me something very wrong about that, because the fact that human beings here, all of humanity, having drives and interests, yet it's going to have to earn a living in something it doesn't necessarily like, where somebody else tells you what to do. Nobody's looking around to see what needs to be done and what you to do about it in terms of your own experience. So one of the things I determined on at that time was that I said, I'm never going to think about how you earn a living. I'm really going to commit myself to what do you see that you think needs to be done, that you feel you know something about, and you can't see anybody else attending to it, and you feel if it isn't attended to, society might be at a great disadvantage. And then what do you need to know in order to be able to do it? So this is more or less where my strategy started at that time. Here I was broke, and say this kind of preposterous way to carry on. But I also felt that I know if you're going to do your own thinking, kind of question I asked myself, it means you're not going to believe anything anymore. I'm going to give up everything I've been told I ought to believe and try to come back to what does your own experience teach you. And so I said, well, one of the things interests me very much, so very fundamental. You've been taught all kinds of, given all kinds of information and things to believe about religions and God. But what in your own experience do you think about this? In your own experience, you think that there is operative in your universe any intellectual and knowing competence greater than that of man. And I said, my experience really tells me I'm overwhelmed by the kinds of things I really learned about principles operative in the universe, so just the principle of gravity, the principle of leverage, that a little man could, with a lever, lift his muscles might handle 200 pounds, and he just his weight over here on the end of the lever, and 1 foot advantage from the fulcrum to the load, and he could lift a ton. I said, these kind of principles I find, they hold true, it doesn't make a difference whether it's a wooden lever or a steel lever, and the mathematical principles absolutely hold fundamentally true, but there are principles operative in our universe which hold true under any special case. Makes me feel that there, and these principles themselves, none of them seem to, as far as I know, ever contradict one another, and they all seem to be inter-accommodated. So there seems to be an a priori set of principles operating in the universe, and there ought to be principles. I don't see how they can be a principle and have a they can't terminate. Therefore, they seem to be eternal. And man doesn't know about them at first, but he simply discovers them to be there a priori in the universe. So I felt we were uncovering an integrity, an a priori integrity, where having a complex of principles that didn't contradict one another, that were inter-accommodated, was really a very great design. And none of these principles had any weight. They were purely metaphysical conceptions. And I differentiated this out a little by saying, for instance, apparently each one of our experiences, we remember in our brain, we store each special case experience. But then from time to time, we discover a principle that seems to be running through all those special case experiences. And having learned such a principle, for instance, as a lover, having discovered the thing that really holds true, then you say, I've discovered a principle, and here's the mathematics of it. Can I design a generalized lover? And you discover you can't. You can only design a special case lover. You have to, whatever lever you design is going to have to be 6 feet or 10 feet or wood or steel, whatever it is. You can't just have a generalized lever. I saw then very interesting that while you and I subjectively have all these special case experiences, mind alone seems to be able to pick out these principles that are running, that are operative between but not of the special case information. They're always relationships. They're very complex, they're relationships. And the fact then that either subjectively, objectively, I always have to be in special case yet that my mind is able to deal and apprehend this absolutely weightless principle itself. And the principle, I say, there ought to be a principle, it must be eternal. And it is weightless as fundamental way of thinking. It is not the special case. Therefore, I said, we seem to have some very extraordinary kind of an awareness, and this awareness is continually discovering a larger and larger set of principles which are operative in the universe, and therefore, I would call that a design. The faithfulness of this behavior is a design in pure principle, and therefore it seems to be sort of an intellectual design which man doesn't invent, but he discovers. So it's obviously a priori. Therefore, I simply say I'm feeling overwhelming evidence of, in my personal experience, that there is something a very great competence operative in our universe a priori to man. So that's the kind of question I began asking myself, and to see how I could answer them out of my experience. And this wasn't talking about a God as a man, but it's something I call something quite superior to man, because man himself is very temporary and very fragile and corruptible. So this integrity, the very word integrity, sees something very, very different. Now, at that time, then, I said, if this child, new child, it's an extraordinary privilege, but perfect responsibility, having this child, looking out for it. I said, if this child could and did develop into what I hope it might develop into, I don't think this child would like it if I spent the rest of my life looking out for her, finding special advantage for her in a world where, to my very rigorous knowledge, there was very great poverty and great pain. And I think this child would only be really likely to be happy about what I had done if I really committed myself to using the kind of experience I have had to see what I might do about eliminating the pains and doing other things to facilitate moral lives and see any way you could really be very effective in giving advantage to that life. Now, so I began to think, and here you are, you're absolutely broke, you are, the only thing you actually have is experience, and it's just fairly run-of-the-mill experience. You have quite a lot of them. And what could the individual do in the era of this massive corporations and massive state, great government? They seem to have a very great advantage, and people think about money as being essential. So I came to the conclusion that there probably were a great number of things an individual could do that the government couldn't do, or the great corporation couldn't do. In the first place, there's nobody to stop me thinking. There's nobody to stop me thinking comprehensively about the whole world. By operating as a government, I have to be considered of them as of the country are. By thinking in the terms of a corporation, I have to think within some country. I said, I can really think about the whole show, and made up my mind to do so. Now, suddenly I've become absolutely convinced that I'd heard an enormous amount of talk on the part of my fellow men trying to persuade each other about this and that, and I never really saw anybody importantly convinced, certainly not changing behaviors. They might, if you gave them the right information, they might be grateful for the right information they happen to be, but as far as telling people how they ought to behave, I saw that didn't happen at all. And so I said, if I'm going to try to be useful to my fellow man, I'm now already 32 years of age, I don't have so many years to count on, I'm never going to ask my fellow man to listen to me. I'm not going to try to persuade my fellow man to behave in ways that other than the way he is behaving. I think none of us know enough about each other. I think it's a very mysterious matter. But I am convinced I might be able to help my fellow man by, instead of trying to reform him, commit myself to seeing what I could do with rearranging environment. To me, the word environment means everything. To each human being, environment is everything that isn't me. And it's a very big, complex affair. There is really me and the environment, and then you have the universe. So each human being, the conditions he's born in have very great deal to do with where he behaves. And so I said, for instance, there's a great river, torrential river, and there's people living on this side. There's a lot of resources that are very helpful to the people on this side if they can get over there. And from time to time, they try to cross, and they get caught in the stream, and have a very miserable time. If I build a bridge, I don't have to try to persuade anybody to use a bridge. They just automatically use a bridge. So this seemed to me to be self-evident, and I've committed myself to that kind of program. I'd like to before I go really any further, I find it very important with myself, and I hope it's important to you, to discover how little I know and discover how many powerfully conditioned reflexes I have that are very difficult to cope with. In the first jobs that I ever had before World War I, the men I worked with were all skilled craftsmen. They were magnificent craftsmen. And yet they were pretty taciturn. They had very small vocabularies, maybe about 100 words, of which about 50% were blasphemous or obscene. And when I came to work with those men for the first time, I came from Harvard vocabulary. And this, my vocabulary seemed so strange to them that they suggested that I might be sex deviant. And I didn't think it by experimental evidence that I was sex deviant, so I didn't want to be misidentified. If I had been sex deviant, I think it had been okay. But the point was, I don't think it was. So. I didn't see any way to rectify the situation outside of simply speaking their language instead of mine. So that's obviously what brought it about. So I became really very colorful too in my language, and there was no longer any misidentification. Now, that was long before our first child was born. And when this second child came in, this moment in 1927, I, in thinking about what I had learned and what I thought were useful tools, I was very deeply impressed with tools. I had learned how to use tools, and as a mechanic, many kinds of tools. And to me, one of the most impressive matters I could conceive of was the dictionary, and had to do with those words. Because you and I know how difficult it is to get human beings to agree on anything important. That there are dictionaries with 100,000 words in them, and that humanity had agreed that there are 100,000 nuances of experience that had to be identified, and that these 100,000 words were the right words to identify it with. It seemed to me the most extraordinary victory of man. And I couldn't think of anything more really fundamentally profound than that we have that kind of a long inheritance of those tools, communication. So I said at the time that I'm trying to reorganize myself to be useful. I'm never going to say things in the most inefficient ways. I'm going to try to say whatever I have to say. I know that my reflexes are very badly conditioned. In fact, I gave myself more or less a moratorium on speech for over a year. almost 2 years, and I said, I'm never going to begin to make sounds until I'm pretty sure I know what they mean. I said, these are beautiful, these tools, but it's just easier to teach parrots those words. And they have no meaning whatsoever. So humanity was really using fantastic numbers of words without really thinking about what the meaning was. They had very good and important sensations and thoughts and so forth. They'd like to communicate, but simply using the awkward tools. And these blasphemous ones or the obscene ones, they were proposing that people do all kinds of things you can't possibly do, let alone really get at what it is you do want done. Yeah. So I resolved in 1927 never again to use blasphemous or obscene words. I was sure that I wasn't, just because I didn't. I wasn't doing it because I disliked them. I just said they're just much more ineffective. I want to use the right words. So having disciplined myself since that time not to use blasphemous words and obscene words, I get kind of shocked from time to time because I'm old enough now so that it happens I more or less own 55 automobiles in succession. You never really own them, you just buy them on time. But I finally came to the point where life was unfolding in such a way that I began to leave my cars at airports and never come back to them. And I was paying a lot of rent, so I arranged to have an agent sell them, and I made up my mind from there on to just rent the car at the place I came to. And that seemed to be really very satisfactory. I never thought it would be so satisfying, but it seemed to be very, very much so. Anyway, I still drive approximately as much as I ever did, and this is quite a lot. And I'm going along the street, and suddenly somebody will come out of an alleyway, a blind drive, much too fast, and I say, Jesus Christ! And I don't really want Jesus Christ at all. All I'm getting at is that the reflexes that we have are very, very powerful, and they're not easy for us to get out. Now, I'm sure that every one of you in this audience, because I've checked every audience I've ever come to, and I've never had any exception, I'm sure every one of you use the words up and down. Any hands showing that people do not use the words up and down? Now, the words up and down were invented by man to accommodate a long conditioned reflex. Average man, his total lifetime, sees less than a millionth of the surface of his earth. So it is not surprising that in the great plains here of the sea, to think of the world as a plane going on infinity. Nobody's been out there in the field and you just don't know anything about it. As far as you can see, it's a plane. You know there's some mountains and valleys and aberrations, but by and large it's a great plane goes on to infinity. If it were, and this is a long-held concept of man, of a world, sort of an infinite sandwich between heaven and hell, and goes on to infinity. If it were a plane, one plane, as you know geometrically, all the perpendiculars to the same plane would have to be parallel to one another. That's very simple. And because the directions, up and down, that's where the words came from. So if you're still using, you're still thinking flat earth, you're reflexing that way. If you're still seeing logical to you. Now, you say, oh, I don't really think that. I know it's a sphere. Everybody knows it's a sphere. I was asked to give the quarterly address to the faculty club of Masters Institute of Technology, and I asked if anyone in that audience would contradict it. I said, I would like to see their hands, and there were no contradictions. What I said was that all you scientists go home from leaving MIT and you're joining your family or your best girl, your wife, and say, to see an evening and say, darling, look at that beautiful sunset. And all you scientists see the sun going down and you see the sun rising. I know all you scientists have known for 500 years that the sun is not going down and not rising, but the point is you still see it that way. Anybody in this audience that did not see that right, and so I found there were no contradictions. This scientist was 500 years out of gear in their theory, and where they reflect. Now, what all I'm saying to you, as I try to give you a good example, you all know a great deal theoretically, but what we do in this condition reflex is not what we do between times when we talk about it. It's what we do when the pinch comes. As I say, they are reflexing when there was a surprise. And I simply say, we are really in a very great peril on board of our planet due to these condition reflexes. And I'm going to explore a few more of them, because I don't get anywhere myself with my own thinking until I begin to really look into this matter to see what it is I really am capable of thinking about, what I'm capable of doing. But certainly, I said, go back to that environmental business. If I give you the right environment, I can often get people reflex in a very effective way, despite their negative set.